I'm speaking today with Council Member Ed Gonzalez, who is the incumbent in District H and my district council member. Councilman, thank you for taking the time to talk to me today. You're in your second term, and you are also serving this term as the mayor pro tem. So talk to me a little bit about what your second term has been like and what exactly it is that the mayor pro tem does.
Sure. It's been great, and it's great to visit with you as well. It's been a great experience. Time really flies. That's what you hear when you're coming into council, and I could definitely attest to that. It goes by really quick. The second term has been very rewarding. I have had an opportunity to really engage on a number of good, important policy decisions, I think, that are a good step forward for Houston, and hopefully we'll see the benefits in years to come. So I've been very rewarding in that regard, and as Mayor Pro Tem, I sit next to the mayor, and I offer assistance when she has to step away from the council table, for example. I'll chair meetings in her absence, and in the events when she's out of the city on travel or anything, then I step in the role of mayor during her absence.
Now, I've often heard it said that council members kind of spend their first term learning the ropes and their second term getting stuff done, and I mean, I guess the thing is, though, that you know, while you're getting stuff done, you're also looking down at the end of your time on council, because it's only three terms. You know, from where you are, what is it that you haven't gotten done yet that you still want to be able to get done before term limits kicks in on you?
Sure. Well, I'm very passionate about complete streets. I think that we definitely need to have a paradigm shift in terms of how we look at design in our city, for example, and really take advantage, in my opinion, of the importance of Rebuild Houston to also have a do-over in terms of the design of our streets. I think they should incorporate other users of the city right away, those with disabilities, maybe seniors that can't drive, or maybe a young person that chooses not to drive, they'd rather cycle to and from places. And so that's something that's definitely on the top of my agenda, and also to continue to work on key public safety initiatives that hopefully will continue to make our city and community safer.
Okay. I mean, a lot of your district encompasses parts of the Heights and a lot of neighborhoods, you know, close to downtown. As you know, I mean, there's a whole lot of development going on in these kind of dense inner neighborhoods, and some of it runs into resistance from the existing homeowners, like in the my neighborhood, the Woodland Heights, and in District C, and especially, you know, homeowners tend to be, you know, the neighborhood folks tend to be frustrated because there's not a whole lot they can do to exercise control over their own neighborhood when a developer wants to put up, you know, a high rise in the midst of, you know, one, you know, single family homes. I know that Houston has, you know, done a review of Chapter 42, its development code, and that's all been done. But, you know, looking forward, you know, where do you see weaknesses in this and opportunities, maybe, you know, in our famous no zoning city, you know, to maybe change things a little and give homeowners, if they want it, you know, some more control over their neighborhood?
I mean, yes. One thing that I've tried to do in some of these examples that you reference is to try to at least convene some groups of community leaders or community residents to also hopefully meet with some of the developers to at least voice some of the concerns so that developer is aware of them. I think that's something that's not really built into the process at all, where there's not a lot of community engagement up front. Basically, it tends to be between a transaction between the city and the developer with very little discussion up front on potential impacts that perhaps could be maybe resolved or softened a little bit in between. It's very frustrating for us as well in this role, because we too are very constrained with the fact that we don't have zoning, and there's very little that can be done unless they're specifically asking, like, for a variance or something like that. And so that too is very frustrating. I think that going forward, we do need to renew our city in many areas that needs renewal, needs to make sure we're still being attractive to a growing population that we anticipate will continue to come, simply because the city of Houston continues to be an affordable place, and it's a job mecca. So a lot of individuals will still be attracted to the city, especially college graduates that are looking for a place to establish roots, and there's jobs and affordability. I think the challenges have to be hopefully from us to see and learn from some of the negative impacts that have occurred, especially within the Loop. And I previously represented many more of those communities, so I know firsthand how very poor use of right-of-way. And so you have increased density with poor use of right-of-way and really no understanding of the impacts that traffic and poor infrastructure, aging infrastructure can have. So I think that we definitely need to make sure that we are incorporating better safeguards up front in the design process and permitting process to make sure that we're not having the for example, the mailboxes for dense developments maybe on the sidewalk and no one really reviewed a site plan, and also trying to see how we could close out some of these projects before they get final approvals, if you will. I've often thought of maybe some kind of a C of A, certificate of appropriateness, like we do many times with businesses, before we close out a residential development, make sure that everything was done right, because we find ourselves many times being reactive and responding after the fact, or somebody purchased the property without knowing that there were pending red tax or other issues that were being caused, especially maybe with alleyways that were developed or you know, with concrete was placed in there, and some now it's causing flooding on an adjacent neighbor. And so those are things that I think we need to be more diligent about in trying to address that and making sure we're having better communication in-house as well between Public Works, for example, and also planning and development as well. There, we need to be talking within organizations. So I think we should rethink at some point how we deliver services and how we're reviewing all of these developments.
One thing that's going on in District H is the completion of the rail extension, the North Line extension, should be scheduled to open later this year. Talk to me a bit about how that experience has been. There's always concerns when construction is going on about how it affects, you know, the people living and working there. You know, how did this process differ from when the Main Street line was built? And, you know, look forward, and what do you see happening once that line is open and being used?
Sure. I'll start with maybe the negatives or some of the more negative aspects of it have been the hardships on businesses, seeing the obviously they are impacted. We're just talking to some of the area businesses where they don't have the same customer volume that they once did, and obviously it's human nature. People tend to stay away from some heavy construction areas. So when I came on, they were already being developed, but you saw some of the impacts already taking place with businesses, especially during the periods of heavy construction, which now is pretty much ended the heavy construction period. So now we're seeing a more sense of recovery now, but it still took a big hit, and some businesses did close. And so that's been one of the hardships, as well as some of the issues that have arisen prior to full rollout of the light rail, just little things that have happened that maybe weren't designed or thought of properly. And we've been able to work with Metro collaboratively to try to address some of those community concerns. And so it's been an interesting experience. And I think sometimes the challenge, too, is that you're dealing with two major organizations, both Metro and the City of Houston. And sometimes it's easy for one organization to feel that maybe the other side isn't approving everything they want to do. So it's kind of a finger pointing, if you will. So as an elected leader, it's trying to navigate through some of that bureaucracy and trying to come up with a better product for the community. Long term, I think that we'll see benefits. I think a city of this magnitude needs to have multi-modes of transportation. I think that we also need to obviously make sure that we're sustaining our current bus model that many people depend on and is still the most dependable because it reaches further, around the 600 square miles, if you will, of the city. And then obviously we need to address regional issues as well. But I think, we need multi-modes of transportation. So I think this is one more. And ultimately, I'd like to see a future expansion, especially to our airports. I think many of the world-class cities have that kind of connection, and I think the more we move in that direction, I think that's a good thing.
Okay. You are on the city's finance committee, so responsible for the budget and the long-term finance outlook. This year, of course, the city's financial picture is in much better shape than it was 2 years ago and had to make all those cuts. Services have been restored, budget's in pretty good shape. You know, Talk to me a little bit about what your view is of the city's finances now, not just for this budget, but, you know, look forward, and what do you see coming down the line?
Well, I think that one of the things we need to take note is that a large percentage of our budget does go to personnel. And so many times there's not as much flexibility to really make a lot of wholesale changes in terms of unless you plan to have layoffs of some kind or reduction in services. So that's always something that we have to look at going forward is what are the needs and desires of our constituents at large, and then you know, going forward, what are things the city must do and continue to do, and what are maybe services that maybe we can rethink a little bit or pivot to something else, and also use maybe technology. I'm a big proponent of more data decision, more data-driven decision making, where we're looking at data and really determining better use of city services and equipment and assets. So I think we should continue to move in that direction. That's something that I've advocated for very strongly. And so, and then obviously everybody's aware that there is a pension discussion that we need to have. Obviously, it's something that gets discussed quite a bit. And I think we should have an honest, frank discussion about that, about how these pensions are funded, look at hard numbers, look at the reality of them as well, and then determine and keep in mind that this is a 30-year outlook that we're looking at. And then also not looking only now, but incoming employees down the road as well, so that maybe we can learn from some of the lessons of the past going forward with new incoming employees in the future that perhaps could come in with different systems or different options as well when it comes to their retirement payments.
Since you talk about pensions, of course, the headline issue there has been the city's dispute with the firefighters' pension system. Over, you know, the city does not have the right to meet and confer with them. They've been trying to get the legislature to pass or even sponsor a bill to allow that, but so far no action has been taken. Do you support the efforts to pass a bill to require the firefighters to meet and the firefighters' pension to meet and confer with the city?
I'm a supporter of our public safety personnel, perhaps because of my background. Maybe I have that perspective of it. But, you know, I feel that their pension fund is one of the most funded anywhere in the country. I think it's one of the top 10 in terms of, I think they're 85-90% fully funded in terms of their pension. And so I understand that over these next coming years, there are going to be some fluctuations in payment. And obviously the market, the crash that occurred in 2008 also had some major impacts on the system as a whole. I think that, I'm just a firm believer that there was a mutual agreement in developing these pension systems at some point, even from previous administrations, clearly, where both sides signed off on these things. These are benefits that have been earned. And I think that we have to be mindful of that and respectful of that, not simply just say that maybe we can't afford it or it's too much. I think there needs to be an honest dialogue about that. And happen and listen to both sides. And obviously, if there's decisions that we need to make, then we need to make those as a city. Then that's something we seriously need to consider. At the same time, we need to be mindful that these were obligations that we took on. And I think the fact that we're trying to move away from general obligation, trying to use, to keep financing the debt and all this over and over, I think that, we've tried to get away from that. And so dealing with the pension obligation bonds. And so I think we just need to have more dialogue on these sides and be mindful, because at any point down the road, if we do something that also harms our firefighters and public safety professionals, then I think we're also sending a message for others that could potentially want to take on these as potential careers and see this as part of their compensation package.
You also serve on the Public Safety Committee. I mean, you're the chair of the Public Safety Committee, I believe, yes?
Yes.
There's actually been a fair amount of action on that lately, what with the formation of the government corporation? I'm not sure. I can't remember the right term off the top of my head. Yeah. For the forensics.
Yes,
for the
Independent Crime Lab.
Yeah, and also some motion to close the city jail and get the city out of that and contract with the county, and also the sobriety center. Give me an overview of, I mean, how are these things going, and what's the bottom line effect for the city?
Yeah, well, I've been very proud to chair the Public Safety Committee. It's personally
Local
rewarding.
Government Corporation, that's
yes,
it.
LGC. It's been personally rewarding for me just because I've been able to take a leading role in helping move forward, for example, the Sobering Center, which is something that I personally helped champion, as well as the most recent group homes ordinance as well, that I think will greatly benefit not only those in need, but potentially really just better policy for the city of Houston in those two regards, the group homes and Sobering Center. The LGC, the creation of the LGC to move into a more independent crime lab model, I think was a good one, simply because we couldn't stay we're in the place where we were at before. I think there had been a cloud of issues that had hampered the crime lab when it was under the umbrella of HPD, and I think it would be a long discussion to say which ones were deserving and which ones weren't deserving. But I think the fact of the matter is, moving to a true independent model where it's now run by will be run by scientists and more technical experts is a good thing, without it having the cross-pollination, if you will, under the police department. So I think that's a good model, ideally, and I think we've all advocated for this, is it would be great to have a joint facility with the county or other community partners. I think that makes sense. But clearly, we can't wait for both organizations here, the City of Houston and the county, to agree on everything to make this happen. So I think we've moved to a model that makes sense for us and still leaves the door open for potential collaboration down the road, where they can also join the LGC and be equal partners to this. So I hope that day does come. But I think that's also definitely a step in the right direction. And we're trying to address, we dealt with our rape kit backlog that was very much overdue, and also bring in more of a sense of true independence to the crime lab. So I think those are positive moves.
Now, the public safety is, of course, the biggest part of the city's budgets, 65%, give or take.
Yes.
When people talk about the city's long-term financial health, they talk a lot about pensions, and sometimes they talk a bit about health care costs. But, the public safety budget is the biggest chunk of the budget. And, I talk to a lot of council members and people who want to be council members, and, nobody ever really talks about, are we spending the right amount on public safety? Are there opportunities to maybe find some efficiencies and save some money, or just spend less on it? What's your view on that?
Well, my view, I think, is one of the things that there's been discussion about is having a work demand analysis to really see what the true manpower needs are for the city. I think all estimates indicate that Houston will continue to grow population, so it's kind of hard when we're talking about the police department to think in terms of maybe losing personnel when we anticipate growth in population. We're also a very spread out city. I think one of the things that will help us in a policy side is that we're hopefully going to see more densification occurring, because I think we could see cost savings in terms of how we deploy resources. When you have more density, it cost us the same amount of money for an officer to drive 1 mile with low density as if they're driving that same mile with more density. And so I think that could be something that we look at as we make these other policy decisions based on development. And so I think that's something that needs to be incorporated. I think we also need to be looking at how do we make better use of technology. And I'm not talking only about, the discussion over red light cameras, for example, but just using cameras as a force multiplier when we're dealing with issues such as littering, for example, illegal dumping, and things that police are responsible for to some extent to investigate some of those crimes as well, that maybe by having cameras and good deployment of that, we could make better use of that. Maybe considering as well, there's cameras in many places, maybe seeing how we could leverage that, maybe public-private partnerships. I believe the West Chase District is a model, a pilot program, if you will, where the police collaborates with the private sector in terms of utilization of cameras. So I think that we have to think, what has the police department done traditionally in terms of policing, and then what are the current needs now? For example, maybe we could deploy more bicycle officers, you know, on some of our hike and bike trails as we increase that. That would increase those trails to make them more safer, you know, have more visibility, more presence by the police officer, and you're reducing, you know, the use of more vehicles. You know, maybe the city has changed over the last 30, 40 years. And so have we been doing the same things the same ways? Maybe what got us here isn't going to get us where we need to be. There's a lot of petty crime that still goes on in many of our communities. And so how do we better address that? And how do we make some of these homes safer? How do we have more of a presence in these communities instead of just spreading them out? We need to see what, using that data-driven decision-making to really see, you know, what are the crime trends in different neighborhoods? You know, you might have a greater need for more, you know, investigation in terms of burglary and thefts instead of just having a citywide approach. Maybe it needs to be more targeted and focused to the areas that are being hit more greater with burglaries, with auto thefts and those type of things, instead of just having, you know, a model that spreads all across the city. So I think that those kind of discussions still need to take place. But I think that going forward, policing continues to change and the challenges are out there continue to be very high. How is the situation that happened in Boston, for example, going to impact public safety at large-scale events? We host a lot of events here locally. There's a lot more demonstrations now. Those are, you know, additional cost on public safety that perhaps years past when those weren't as active, now they are. And so all these things continue to change policing. So, you know, we have to kind of continue to stay, you know, right ahead of the curve if we can.
Okay. As you know, in 2001, there was a charter amendment that was passed that forbade the city from offering domestic partner benefits to its employees. Times are a little different now. Supreme Court made its ruling on Defense of Marriage Act, which is a federal thing, but still, a number of Texas cities and have adopted domestic partner benefits, although they can't call them that. Do you foresee, would you support an effort, if one were to come, in the city of Houston to change that charter amendment and allow the city to offer domestic partner benefits to its employees?
Yes, it's a matter of equality, and I stand fully behind that.
Okay. An issue that came up before council a while back that I think is going to come up again had to do with the food trucks, in particular allowing them to operate downtown. I mean, you know that cities gained quite a reputation lately for being a great food town, and food trucks are at the forefront of that. But current regulations prevent them from operating downtown in the same manner as they operate elsewhere in the city. Would you support an effort to change the ordinances to allow them to operate downtown the way they're wanting to?
Yes, I am supportive. I think in the committee discussion, you know, a lot of my questions kind of surfaced around, you know, that position. Obviously, I'd like to see what the administration would put forward in terms of a proposal to see. But in principle, I do support that. I think that everyone should have a right to compete in the marketplace. And I think if we have restrictions, then they should be substantiated and be able to be strongly defended. And then maybe we should reconsider if there's a danger or a reason why. But I've yet to really hear that defense and protection of the way it currently stands. And I think we shouldn't have something in place simply to not allow someone to compete in that regard.
All right. Pretty sure I know the answer to this question, but I'm asking everyone I talk to. So, for the record, who do you support for mayor this fall?
I support Mayor Parker. I think she's done a good job, and I think she deserves to finish out the job that she started and have an extra term, her last term, to finish the job.
All right. And, of course, you're running for your third term. No opponents yet that I know of, but the filing deadline is still several weeks away. Why should people vote to give you a third term on city council?
I think I've been an effective council member. I think I've been accessible to my constituents. I think I've been a hard worker. I think I've taken on policy issues that I think, again, will make the city better. If you look at the Sobering Center, for example, the 19,000 people that we used to arrest now will have hopefully much better positive outcomes at a reduced cost of dealing with that population, where before it was about $6 million. Now it's down to about $1 million, $1.5 million. So we saved money and had hopefully better outcomes, and we're seeing some results already. The group homes legislation, my efforts on complete streets, I want to finish the job that I started. I helped launch and create the city's Innovation and Technology Advisory Board that helped launch, with the mayor's support, our first hackathon. And now we'll be doing a tech street event in the fall that isn't only to make sure that Houston is the leading city in the 21st century in terms of innovation and technology, but that we also leverage the fact that between Houston, Austin, and Dallas, we have more gaming companies than the Silicon Valley does, but we never brand ourselves as that. And that really helps even our youth, because hopefully we can help them not only play video games, but help design the video games and design those technologies here in Houston and create jobs. So it helps our local job base, our local economy. It helps our students really grow and really pursue these high-skill, high-paying jobs that are here in place. So I think it's a win in a number of levels. I've helped lead that effort to help create that type of Innovation and Technology Advisory Board to help guide and make recommendations in terms of policy that hopefully will be helpful to the mayor. And so those are things that I think are very positive for the city of Houston. And so I think that those are things that we should continue to keep pursuing in the city. And I feel that I'm the best qualified for this job, and I think I've done a good job, as I promised I would do when I first took office. And, obviously, you make some people mad along the way, but I think by and large people would have very good things to say about my service on council so far, and I'd like an opportunity to finish a job that I started here.
All right. Councilmember Gonzalez, thank you very much for talking to me today.